And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. This hour, we visit with Dr. Andy Lee Roth. He's the Associate Director of Project Censored 2014. He's a history professor as well. Project Censored was begun in 1976, and a large number of students and scholars monitor the reporting of what's presented on TV Nightly News and other corporate media. And he joins us from San Rafael, California. Welcome to you, Dr. Andy Lee Roth.
Thanks so much, Joseph. It's a pleasure to join you on Topical Currents.
Hi, Doctor.
Are you on a speakerphone, Doctor?
Excuse me?
Are you on a speaker?
No.
Oh, could you just speak up a little bit? You're a little bit soft.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, hi. I'd like to begin with an overview of Project Censored, if you would. You know, the founding history, mission, and what you've done and what you'd still like to do.
Well, our mission is really twofold. We have, on the critical side, we try to expose and oppose news censorship in whatever form it may take. And this often means, for us at Project Censored, undertaking critical evaluation of corporate news coverage for when it's failing to give the American people and our community members the news we need to be informed citizens, active community members. On the positive side, we aim to promote the importance and the significance of truly independent investigative journalism, the importance of a truly free press for the democratic process. And we've been doing this since 1976, when Project Censored was founded by Carl Jensen, a professor at Sonoma State University here in California. And over the years, the project has evolved, but our core mission about the importance of a truly free press for an informed and active democratic self-government has remained the same. One of our recent developments, and it's so exciting to be on the air with you this morning, one of the recent developments of the project over the last few years has been we've expanded from a home base of Sonoma State University in California to have a college and university affiliates program that spans the country. And this year's book, which includes the top 25 list of the most censored news stories, that we put out that list every year. This year's book, the top 25 list, is the joint collaborative effort of 219 undergraduate students, 59 faculty members, and 13 community members from 18 college and university campuses across the country. And I'm excited to talk about that, especially this morning, because two of those faculty affiliate campuses are right there in Florida. Florida Atlantic University has been a major contributor to the project over the past few years, and also Indian River State College in Fort Pierce. At both schools, we're consistently getting students doing this hands-on training in critical thinking and media literacy skills and contributing stories that end up in our top 25 lists on a consistent basis.
In the book, you discuss the, quote, new age of citizen journalist, but how can we be sure of the integrity, experience, and news knowledge of someone who's just blogging, and whether we can really take what they say for truth?
Right. Well, I think there's a difference. There's a difference, obviously, between news and opinion. And there's a difference, I would say, furthermore, between reporting and journalism. And so a lot of what we're doing in these Project Censored affiliated classes at campuses across the country and what we do through the book and online on our website is to try to kind of inform people, if this is part of the media literacy component of the project, like how do you evaluate a story for its credibility, for and so things we're doing, the stories that we bring forward in our top 25, which are reviewed in the first instance by students, we're looking at the importance of the story, the timeliness of the story, and then more subtle things like the quality and range of the sources that the story is based on. So if we're talking about the simple comparison to blogging, one of the basic things I would say that we do in terms of critical thinking and media literacy is just claims need to be supported with evidence. And the evidence needs to bear up to critical scrutiny. And if it doesn't, it may be important as opinion or perspective, but it's not news in the sense that we're talking about it. So we're evaluating these stories along these fairly rigorous criteria, and the stories that make up the top 25 in our list each year, they undergo no fewer than 5 rounds of such review, independent and different people at each stage. So they're thoroughly vetted, and as I say, the students play an important role in that. So that we're really excited at the project about trying to educate a next generation of really savvy, informed and skilled, not just media consumers, but also media producers.
Now, you say there's an 18 to 24-month time lag between coverage of stories by independent journalists and the corporate media coverage.
That's something we're starting to document that systematically now. We've kind of been following it as a hunch, as it's a kind of rule of thumb. And what we're starting to see, so for instance, in Censored 2012 and Censored 2013, our previous yearbooks, we had stories about among our top 25 underreported stories were stories on the U.S. drone campaign in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia and other places around the world. Mm-hmm. And what we're finding now is that, okay, in 2014, our top 25 list doesn't have any drone stories this year. And that's not because drones aren't still important news. There's something that every American should be informed of and concerned about, indeed, but that the corporate media has effectively caught up now. And although we would still in some ways be critical of some of the coverage coming out of the corporate media, the fact of the matter is that at this stage, the reporters at the New York Times and the Washington Post and other prominent outlets are doing a pretty solid job now on covering that story. The issue, though, is that 18 to 24 months lag, if you look at the statistics about how many civilians, children, women, non-combatants have been killed by drones in that time period, it does raise for me personally the question of what if we'd had more thorough coverage of the drone program a year and a half to 2 years ago? How many innocent lives might have been saved?
Well, are any innocent lives being saved now that it is being covered?
That's also a legitimate question. I mean, the existing coverage is not without its flaws. And this goes to kind of a basic insight in the sociology of news production, which is that in terms of the corporate media, the people who count as primary sources of information and opinion for them are by and large government officials. Now, if we're talking about the drone story, if you look at the corporate news coverage of drone strikes when there's a drone strike in Pakistan, you will never see a U.S. official quoted, not even off the record. The sources for those stories will tend to be Pakistani officials and occasionally people from aid organizations or civil liberties organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights. So there is still a kind of narrowing quality to that coverage in that we aren't hearing a full range of sources. Some of the people who know the most about these programs are, for security reasons, not at liberty to talk about them. And that's a problem, too. And that's a problem that isn't, in the first place, on the doorstep of journalists who work for corporate outlets. That's a problem with government secrecy, which, of course, is a major theme in the news now.
What are the funding sources of Project Censored?
We receive no funding from any organization or institution. All our funding comes from individual donors. I'll make a shameless pitch here that you can go to projectcensored.org on the website and you can make a donation. Most of our money, all of our money really comes from individual donors, most of whom are making donations at the level of $5 to $10 a month, or they're making a one-time $100 donation. We sell the book, and that's a major source of revenue for us. But as with many nonprofits, we do a lot with a little financially.
We'll have links to the Project Censored 2014 book at our Facebook page, Topical Currents Facebook page, as well as our website, WLRN.org.
And we're going to get to some of these underreported stories, these 25 in your book, but we need to take a short break. We're speaking with Dr. Andy Lee Roth. He's Associate Director of Project Censored, teaches sociology at Sonoma State University and the College of Marin, and the co-author with Mickey Huff, or the co-editor, I should say, with Mickey Huff of Censored 2014, Fearless Speech in Fateful Times. We'll take that break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're visiting with Dr. Andy Lee Roth from Project Censored. He's co-edited the book, Censored 2014, Fearless Speech in Fateful Times. So let's get to some of your stories. I'd like to start with the first one and know why, or ask you why that is the first one. It's that of Bradley or Chelsea Manning. Why is that the number one underreported story this year?
Right. Our number one story is Manning and the failure of corporate media. And just as a clarification before addressing that story itself, our book, published by Seven Stories Press, went to press before Manning announced the change of name from Bradley to Chelsea. So let me give you a kind of snapshot of why that's our number one. This is a kind of anecdote. And it has to do with how the corporate media have covered the revelations around Manning, the trial of Manning, and so forth. In September of this year, Time magazine ran a story called Unchecked Aggression. So Time magazine would be an example of what I mean when we refer to the corporate media.
Okay.
It's owned by and predominantly the coverage serves the interests of the corporate media. Time magazine ran a story that lined up on the sidebar of the story there, pictures of four people: the Fort Hood shooter Nadal Hassan, the Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning, NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, and Navy Yard shooter Aaron Alexis. And all of these, this unlikely quartet, were lined up as evidence of the military security clearance system being tragically broken. So Time magazine, is basically saying Manning and Snowden, these whistleblowers, are the equivalent of people who go crazy with a gun and shoot innocent people. And the story goes on to quote a senator from Montana, John Tester, saying they're not just threatening our national security, but our personal security as well. And the hypocrisy here on this, I think, is that, of course, as Time and other outlets are publishing material that's critical of Snowden or Manning or is undermining their credibility as public figures, they, of course, are relying on the leaks that Manning and Snowden, the information that Manning and Snowden have made public for the very news that they report. So
you're talking about Time is relying on those leaks.
Exactly. Like in the very same issue, right, Time magazine is running stories based on revelations that we only know about because Manning leaked documents or Snowden leaked documents. So it's a kind of shoot the messenger dynamic that is, we see that in, I think, not just with those two figures, but with whistleblowers across the board.
How would you compare whistleblowers today with, say, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. We actually have a brief piece in the book by Daniel Ellsberg where he's discussing the concept that he refers to as civil courage. And I think his perspective on this is perhaps more interesting than mine might be. He says, basically, that what we need is a culture that would value civil courage of the kind that he as Manning and Snowden have exhibited, as much as it respects and as much as we valorize physical courage of the kind, say, that we more readily identify on the battlefield or in other situations where people act in physically heroic ways. So it's interesting. We did an event. We had a conference of kind of cutting-edge media, progressive media people here in San Francisco a month ago, and Ellsberg was our keynote speaker, and he said he said this with kind of the Irish twinkle in his eye. He said it was kind of nice to see that the term whistleblower was now being used, at least in some circles, as a honorific and a compliment rather than a epithet. So I think it has changed in some circles, but I think when you look at the corporate coverage of Manning or Chelsea or Snowden, or some of the other whistleblowers, you know, John Kiriakou is doing time in jail for having exposed, having exposed the torture program, and so he's the first CIA connected person to spend any jail time relative to waterboarding. But he wasn't involved in waterboarding. He's the person who leaked information about that program. So. Shoot the messenger, as I say, seems to be the theme in the corporate news for figures of this sort.
How do you see the state of independent journalism today in the U.S. compared to other nations?
I think we live in a period of our country's history, in a period where the independent press has never been more robust than it is right now. And while I think you can look at the WikiLeaks and the Guardian stuff and look at it with a half full, half empty, I think part of what's happening is the American public is becoming sensitized to the fact that the corporate media are not giving us the news we need. And there's a disenchantment there. So, and this isn't just my opinion or the Project Censored party line. There's actually a very interesting Pew Research Center report, The State of the News Media in 2013, with I'll just summarize two key points from the Pew Research study. On one hand, the number of Americans who don't trust major news sources has risen dramatically over the past years. At the same time, they do a content analysis of those major news sources, and what they find is that those outlets, so places like CNN, Fox, MSNBC, are increasingly broadcasting opinions rather than straight factual reporting. So I think this is a really interesting time for independent journalism, because I think there's a hunger in our country for fact-based reporting. You know, that if only we could spend some time in a sort of no-spin zone, we might be able to figure out more clearly the trajectory we, you know, as community members, as citizens, want to take our country.
But aren't the major TV networks and cable stations giving people really what they want? A lot of people really don't want to get into a very difficult issue and, say, legislation and that. They want to hear about celebrities and what's leading in the police department.
Yes. I mean, I think there is some truth to that. The stories, as we talk about in the chapter introducing our top 25 this year, the stories we bring forward are often challenging. They're sometimes emotionally and psychologically challenging. And so I think there is a sense of, it would be way more comfortable. It would be easier if we didn't know these things. But democracy isn't founded on kind of making it easy for the people to be involved in their own governance. And so tough as some of these stories are, I think we have to confront them, and we have to respect the fact that reporters in many cases are risking their lives in order to bring us these stories. And so we can't become complacent.
Have you documented a downturn in investigative reporting by major metropolitan newspapers because of the financial crunch they've been under?
There's no doubt that that's true. That's not something Project Censored has specifically documented, but organizations like Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the Columbia Journalism Review, I think at this point, I would say, speaking as a sociologist who studies the production of news, I would say this is basically an established truth at this point. And speaking from a more personal footing, I grew up reading the Los Angeles Times, and the Los Angeles Times used to have some of the most outstanding investigative reporting in the nation, I think. I think it could hold up with any paper. But that's no longer true, unfortunately. And I think a lot of that has to do with exactly what you invoked, Joseph, the idea that investigative reporting done well is expensive. It's not conducive to the need for a 24/7 news cycle where the corporate entities are racing to be the first, often at the expense of being accurate. And investigative reporting is slow. But it's crucial. Without it, we don't understand the world we live in.
We don't have too long, but can you talk about number 22, the Pennsylvania law gags doctors to protect Big Oil's proprietary secrets?
Yes, this is a really complicated story. But to simplify it down, basically the argument has been that doctors could not talk to their patients about chemicals that might be entering the groundwater, that might be in the air as a result of fracking in the state of Pennsylvania. So there's, in effect, this kind of gag law there.
Was that an actual law?
That has been passed into law, but the reason the story is complicated is that, as with many, the wording of many legal documents, there are differences of interpretation over what this means. And so when this story first came out, it was reported as a very clear-cut kind of, this is a gag on doctors. They are not allowed. And then there was backpedaling from people involved in the extraction industries, basically saying, oh, no, we would never do that. That's not what we're about. You know, we can protect our proprietary secrets without, you know, endangering patient care. And so forth and so on. But, you know, the importance of keeping proprietary secrets seems fairly small compared to letting the public know what kind of chemicals they and their children might be exposed to.
So, well, we have to be running, Bonnie.
Okay, well, I guess to know more, they will have to read more about it. We've been speaking with Dr. Andy Lee Roth. He's Associate Director of Project Censored, which is projectcensored.org. And he co-edited with Mickey Huff, Censored 2014, Fearless Speech in Fateful Times. We want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you, Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
And we're back with today's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for joining us. Bonnie Berman with you, along with Joseph Cooper. Alan Gerganis's first novel, Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, spent 8 months on the New York Times bestseller list and sold more than 4 million copies. A 700-page epic about love and war, it established Gerganis as one of the leading Southern writers of his generation. His new book, Local Souls, also takes place below the Mason-Dixon line. It's a collection of novellas that follows the bittersweet lives of the citizens of a present-day fictional town in North Carolina, where buried secrets are unearthed like corpses in a flood. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Gerganis. He began by asking him why he dislikes the term Southern fiction.
I think it localizes the universal struggle and pinpoints it in a form of dismissal. I think it's like romantic fiction or science fiction. I'm trying to write work that will be translated into every language in the world, and happily that's happening. It's thrilling to see. So to then be categorized as related to a single region of a single country is inherently minimizing. I don't think of Faulkner as a Southern writer. I think of Faulkner as a great human writer, as a great writer. And everybody has to be from somewhere, Ariel. You know, we all start where we were born. And if we're smart, we look around and make huge advantage of what we saw when we first slithered out of the womb and learned our lessons or didn't. So I'm happy to be categorized as a Southerner, as a gay Southerner, as a crazy white man, as a lapsed Presbyterian. But I don't think any of them really speaks to who I really am as an artist.
Loco Sews is your first book in over a decade, but you weren't suffering from writer's block. You were still writing every day, right?
That's right. At this point, I'm now 66. Writing is like breathing. It's not something you have to think about doing. It's something that you do automatically. And it means for me, as a great-great-grandson of farmers, proving my worth when the rooster gets up and crows in the morning by being at my desk and hacking away with a hoe and a rake and pruning shears at my prose and trying to make something living and beautiful and lasting and that seems true to me. So I have disappeared from publishing, but I've never disappeared from writing. And I think they're from two completely different categories. I'm a little shocked at what I find emerging like Rip Van Winkle from a long sleep. About where American book culture is and how much it's declined in seriousness in the last 10 or 12 years. But for me, the great thrill of being a writer is not being recognized in the airport. It's the privilege of getting up and trying to make sense of this screwy, you know, chaotic world. And it's a kind of sorting that's essential to me for my own sanity.
We're speaking with author Alan Gurganus, whose latest book is a story collection entitled Loco Sews. Loco Sews is a collection of three novellas. Your last book, The Practical Heart, was a collection of novellas too. What is it about the novella that you like?
I think it's the perfect form for the way we live now. Peter Taylor, who was a great practitioner of the form, said it is a unit that can be picked up after dinner and finished by bedtime. And I think that given our hectic schedule and how plugged into our gizmos and monitors we all willingly are, that essentially a work of novelistic depth and resonance and power that can be read in a single sitting is an amazing kind of achievement. And it just happens to coincide with the way I sort of see things. I'm very interested, in fact, obsessed with the idea of obsession. And I'm fascinated with people who give themselves over to a single issue, a single love, a single regret, a single enterprise in their lives, and stake everything on that. And in the fiction, it means that the secondary characters who were in the 19th century novel were often comical characters, some often servant characters or subsidiary characters who came on to make you chuckle before the darkness starts again. I eliminate those and I try to make an arc that is unifying and that builds in velocities to a powerful end. And I want to do that in a long single sitting so that the reader, like listening to a symphony, can have the experience all at once and be my collaborator in a way in the creation of the work.
Well, all three of the novellas in Loco Sews follow characters from the fictional town of Falls, North Carolina. You've written about Falls before. What type of town is it?
It's a town of 6,000 souls. And that makes it a big town in a way. The name Souls in the title is very willfully arrived at. I think a lot of people from bigger cities think little towns are filled with little people. And I'm fascinated with the ethos of the village, the compassion of the village and the savagery of the village. And as you know, from anybody who's ever grown up in a little town, a unit like that can be the most forgiving and the most fierce when it's going against somebody who's wronged one of its own. So I felt that the town needed to be historically rooted. It's founded in the 1840s. It was a cotton mill town. It was a tobacco center, and now the cotton mills have all gone to Mexico, and the tobacco has been proven to be carcinogenic, and there are these gigantic empty warehouses downtown, and people who were tobacconists who smoked and then died of lung cancer and warned their children never to smoke. It's a farm town with access to Raleigh, which makes it a kind of sophisticated village. And it's the most wonderful laboratory area. I love it. I really love it. And I know it. When I dream, I sometimes wander down streets of it I've never visited. It's not my hometown, which is Rocky Mountain. It's not my current hometown, which is Hillsborough, North Carolina. But it's somewhere in between. It's somewhere between the hyperconscious, the willed, and the unconscious. And I know, having started the town with oldest living Confederate widow in 1989, every avenue, every twist and turn, not only of the prosperous white section, but of Baby Africa, which is where the black citizens live. So I literally can walk in my head to a door and knock on the door and see who answers the door. And it's an amazingly fertile zone, and I recommend it to your writing readers, listeners, to invent a town and imagine it and chronicle it.
One novella in the book is called Fear Not. It opens with the narrator, a writer like yourself, attending a school musical. There he meets a charming couple, but he finds out something about them that's disturbing. Maybe monstrous. He decides to investigate their past and write a story about how they got together. The narrator swears 81% of the story is true. Is he telling the truth?
I'm not sure 81.5% is absolutely accurate, but I think he genuinely believes that he has based the fiction on documentation, and there's a lot of legwork. He has to go all over the U.S. to find the information and to live online the way we all do these days. I'm not sure he could tell you which 20% he made up and which he didn't. And I think that's the artist's obligation, is to take the assigned bricks and put mortar between it in varying patterns. And that's what we do with each other. I mean, we've just met. I'm imagining you. I can picture your father and your mother and your siblings and try to make up a history for you. And that's my prerogative as a novelist, is to see people in an airport or to see people at a school play and think, how would I tell their stories, and what must have brought these two extremely unlikely but loving people together? And that became the challenge for this story. I based it in part on Henry James and in part on detective novels. I'm a big fan of Jim Thompson and of Raymond Chandler. And I think James N. Came. I think a lot of people don't take them seriously enough as real artists. And I wanted to write a unit that was filled with suspense, which literally means to withhold information. A suspense novel is a withheld bit of information that's offered only at the end, and that keeps the reader panting forward at a rate that the author determines. So it was a fascinating exercise, and it's unlike anything else I've ever written, and it's much more in the third person, because it has to be filled with information of the lives that I chronicle.
And what I found interesting about that story is that, again, I don't want to give anything away, but the secret of this couple, you're very compassionate about it. Very, the narrator is. Others would, scream bloody murder, but you are, or the narrator's understanding. Is that what fiction does, to try to make that which people would reject automatically more understandable?
That's a great mission for fiction. And I think ideally that's what we're attempting to do. And I think the movement of the story is toward understanding. I think if you've gone through all the living accidents that these two people have withstood, that you tend to want to forgive them by understanding them.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Alan Gurganus. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is novelist and short story writer Alan Gurganus. His new book is called Local Souls, and it's a collection of three short novels set in a small town in North Carolina. Alan, another novella in the book is called Decoy. It contains a powerful description of a flood, but this disaster is more an act of man than of God. You write, "The Department of Interior raffles off the wetlands meant to absorb our runoff rain. With Walmart parking lots paved hard, no sponginess is left. Water's got to go somewhere, so it came picking our locks. So is gentrification jeopardizing the South?"
I think there's a lot to be said for that. I think that one of the things that set us apart from certain other regions is a tremendous love of the land and a deep knowledge of the land. I grew up in a generation where my grandfather had left the farm for running businesses in town, but he kept what is known as a hobby farm, which is not necessarily a fully functioning working farm, but a sentimental attachment, an umbilical connection to the land. And I was very lucky, having been born in 1947, to have access not only to our suburban house, but to my grandparents' Victorian house in the middle of the town, and 6 miles outside of town, the family farm, where we did hunting and berry picking and raised hogs and generally ran wild as children. It was marvelous. It gave me a real sense of the primacy of the land. And I don't think we've been good stewards. That's an understatement. I think we're a suicidal race in a way that we would never have expected it 20 years ago. And we're just waking up and realizing, I think, that we want to live. And even if we don't want to live, we want our children and great-grandchildren to live. And I'm hoping that we can turn the ship of state around fast enough to save the day. But I still think there's a great place for love poems to the earth itself, to mater, to land and dirt. And I've tried to do that in this novella.
Well, you once wrote a story about the difficulty of being gay in the South in the 1950s. You say that back then there was only one way of coming out. It was getting caught. You still live in North Carolina. Are people there more reasonable now?
I think a lot of people have come to terms with the issue precisely because they have a nephew who's gay, or it turns out that their husband is gay, or their son is gay, or their daughter. But the prevailing right-wing thinking that seems to be have a death grip on this culture is still in control in North Carolina, that Republicans control both the House and the Senate and the governor's mansion. And so gay marriage is completely verboten. Anybody can be fired from any job for being gay. And there's still a kind of terror associated with it, at least on the books. I think sometimes it takes legislation and religion a long, 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 long time to catch up with what common citizens are thinking. And I'd like to believe that most people are much more sympathetic than they were a couple of decades ago.
Well, some gays of your generation reacted to homophobia by becoming vehemently anti-gay. You see it with some politicians and religious leaders. I won't name names. Do you have, what are your feelings about these anti-gay gays?
I think most people who have virulent hatred of gay people are responding to something in themselves. I'm not a vegetarian or a vegan, but I don't want to lock everybody up who only eats rutabagas. I mean, what is it about vegans that would drive me to feel that I want to persecute them? I think there's something in sexual experimentation in our early youths that draws a lot of people and makes them feel very guilty about something they did with little Willie behind the barn of a given morning. and that they spend their lives, adult lives, in church on their knees and in the state capitol making laws to mitigate against what they themselves did. I think self-knowledge is the beginning of everything, and I think there's very little of it in evidence in the capitals of our country.
We're speaking with author Alan Gurganis, whose latest book is Loco Souls. Recently, I've interviewed two of your former students, Kate Christensen and Robert Antoni. They have nothing but praise for you. In her memoir, Blue Play Special, Christensen says you were her favorite teacher at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. You inspired her to keep writing. How does one teach creative writing? Or at least, how do you do it?
Well, there, I have to put in a plug for them. Kate Christensen and Robert Antoni are wonderful people and wonderful writers. They're amazing. And they were amazing from the time they were 18. I think listening is in very short supply in our culture. And I think one thing that a creative writing class can provide, which is an extraordinary thing and a prize above oxygen, is to sit a group of people in a room and have everybody listen to the stories that each of them tells in turn. It's an incredibly rare opportunity. And in the best writing classes, there is a whole lot of listening going on. The funny thing about listening is if you listen to other people long enough and hard enough, you begin to hear yourself. That's what education is all about. And since storytelling is inherently communal, you can't do it. You can't sit in a closet and tell stories. You've got to have an auditor. You've got to have a person who responds. And I think that's what creative writing classes at their best can offer. I get a lot of mail from people who say, congratulations, you know, I want you to be the first person to read my 500,000 word novel and it's arriving by UPS. I've never heard of this person. I've never met them. And my suggestion to each of them, I actually have it on my website as a form of self-protection, is to find three or four people, it doesn't take more than five people altogether, who are working at your same level of experience and with your same level of talent, we hope, and read to each other and read each other alive and make that something that you do every other week and make that a living part of your existence and an essential part of your friendships. I don't think you have to have an institutional sanction. In a way, it may be easier to replace people as they age out or they stop being interested in the work without having to go through an administration. But we all need listeners desperately. And I was very lucky to be a listener for Kate and Robert at an early stage of their careers.
Well, you had great teachers, too. Top of the list, of course, is John Cheever. He taught you at Iowa. Cheever, without doubt, is one of America's greatest short story writers. He fell out of favor for a while. Then he came back, and now, you know, he may be falling out of favor again. What was Cheever like?
When you read the biographies, Blake Bailey's biography that was just published a couple of years ago, it's a brilliant, beautiful book. You feel that he must have been a very depressed person. He was alcoholic from an early age. He grew up in a family that had great pretensions to pretension, but had lost all its money. And the mother had to work in a gift shop, and that was a huge come down for the family. And you would think he would be a gloomy Gus, but if you've read the work, you know how joyful the work is. And his company was like that, Ariel. He was so much fun, minute to minute. He was always getting into mischief. I walked around Iowa City with him when I was, you know, 20 years old, 21, and he was 65. And he was always enlisting me in sandlot football games, to which I was not qualified. But nobody could say no to him. And I remember once he sat up in the stands at a high school football yard, and I was playing football, which I didn't play much as a child, and I went for a long one, and I caught a touchdown pass, and it was one of the happiest moments of my life. it was like all the attention that my father had never paid me, John Cheever, who is a genius of American fiction, was expressing by jumping up and down on the stands. Marvelous, he said. Absolutely marvelous. Do another one. Do another one. It was such a thrill to have such a sponsor. And I think if you've had that kind of sponsorship, the only way you can repay it is by finding other interested, talented kids and try to offer that to them.
Did he help you to develop your own voice?
He did. He was not a good teacher in the sense that he could look at a sentence and say, you see why this one works and this one is less good. It was all yes or no with John, and that's sort of how he wrote himself. He would write a whole story in the morning, and if he read it in the afternoon and it was no good, he would throw the whole story out. There was no real revision. He was supporting his wife and three kids and all the orthodontia and boarding schools that required, and a story worked or not, but most of the stories worked magnificently, and that's one of the things he taught me.
Thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Alan Greganis.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. His book reviews sometimes run in the Miami Herald. So that wraps us up. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. And more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is again with Miami-Dade College professor and literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez. He'll visit with the acclaimed novelist Salman Rushdie and discuss Rushdie's new novel, which recounts his underground life after Satanic Verses. And on to the calendar. On this day in 1957, 56 years ago, the birth of TV anchor Matt Lauer in New York City. He began hosting the Today Show in 1997. And on this day in 1959, 54 years ago, the birth of comedian Tracy Ullman in Berkshire, England. The 1987 Tracy Ullman Show was the first hit program of the new Fox network. One more while we ponder 79 career PGA tournament wins. On this day in 1975, 38 years ago, the birth of Eldrick Woods in Cypress, California. The first African-American to win the coveted Masters event, Tiger's the only athlete to earn $1 billion in a career. It's estimated that Tiger's adultery scandal cost corporate shareholders $12 billion in the long haul. The late Sam Snead has 82 wins, or had. So we leave with an old quote from Tiger Woods. Honestly, I think my marriage is only going to help me. I found a person I can talk to and a person who is going to be by my side through thick and thin. Elon has instilled a lot of confidence in me in all aspects of my life. Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for listening in. Here and now from NPR News. Up next.